Nuclear talking points. How to communicate the logical, scientifically proved objections to nuclear to a public that almost never gets the chance to even hear them. The nuclear industry has been pushing the narrative through mainstream media that nuclear energy is somehow the cure for climate change, using its massively funded PR propaganda machine to churn out slanted stories that are easy for the underfunded media to use and convince the public, especially younger people, that nukes really are the good guy saviors in the energy game. But those who oppose nuclear have done the research and know and can substantiate their opposition with footnotes and science, leaving one veteran activist to tell us.
These people are running around saying nuclear power is a solution to global warming and is carbon-free. First of all, it's not carbon-free. Every atomic reactor emits radioactive carbon-14, and they also emit massive quantities of carbon dioxide in producing the fuel, mining, milling, enriching, transporting the fuel, and then storing it when it's waste. So atomic energy is a global warming disaster. In no way, shape, or form is it a solution for the climate crisis, nor is it carbon-free.
That's esteemed veteran anti-nuclear activist Harvey Wasserman with a short list of verifiable truths about the negative impact of nuclear energy. But how do we share that information with the public in a way that they can easily access and understand, that counters the massive propaganda juggernaut that the nuclear industry has been funding and promoting for years? Well, that's what we'll learn about as Harvey explains an organizing plan to empower those of us who oppose nuclear in communicating to the public the genuine truths about that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away, so I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a talk with veteran activist, author, and organizer Harvey Wasserman, who explains about putting together a network of podcasts, writers, Substacks, YouTubes, and more that will, in a coordinated way, put our own talking points out that the public will be able to find, understand, share, and hopefully act upon. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, Numbnuts of the Week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, Jack Cohen Joppa of the Nuclear Resistor with another story from our history of successful activist resistance, and more honest nuclear information than in all the U.S. congressional hearings this week on the Trump cabinet nominees. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, January 28, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists moved the doomsday clock, which is meant to warn the world as to how close to a total Armageddon we are, exactly 1 second forward, from 90 seconds to 89 seconds to midnight. We'll have a full analysis and an interview on this on next week's program, Nuclear Hot Seat number 710. In Japan, in a deeply disappointing move, Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba plans to skip the UN nuclear weapons ban treaty meetings in New York this March, and no government representatives will attend. However, a group of lawmakers from Japan's ruling parties may attend, though not in an official capacity. These plans come in the wake of Nihon Hidankyo, the Japanese atomic bomb survivors group, winning last year's Nobel Peace Prize, and the ruling Liberal Democratic Party's coalition partner urging the Prime Minister to participate in the convention as an observer. Japan is not a party to the international agreement, which took effect in 2021, and the government has skipped the first two meetings. Despite having been the only country to have suffered from the use of nuclear weapons in war. In this case, ignorance is not bliss, it's madness. In France, according to a report by the Court of Auditors, the country's financial court, France is still far from being ready to implement its program for the construction of six new EPR2 nuclear reactors due to the financial and technical uncertainties surrounding this project carried out by EDF. And in Germany, Susan Crane of Redwood City, California, was released from prison in Koblenz, Germany on January 17 after spending 7.5 months incarcerated over protest trespass convictions stemming from a string of bold protests against the U.S. nuclear weapons stationed at Germany's Buchel Air Force Base southeast of Cologne. She is 81 years old. And now...
Nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, numbnuts of the week.
Robert Peters, a research fellow at the Heritage Foundation, the conservative think tank behind the evil-spirited Project 2025, argued in a thread on X, formerly Twitter, that the, quote, U.S. must be ready to test nuclear weapons at the Nevada National Security Site, adding that it would, quote, allow the U.S. to conduct open-air nuclear testing within the U.S. or in the Pacific over open water or uninhabited atoll, end quote. Are you out of your frickin' mind? We've had treaties against that dating back to the 1960s. The reason we stopped testing nuclear weapons in the open air, which sends radioactive material dozens of miles into the atmosphere, is that it was spiking cancer rates in people living nearby the downwinders, and strontium-90 from fallout was showing up in baby teeth around the world. Nuclear weapons expert Stephen Schwartz wrote in a series of posts on Blue Sky, such a monumental reversal would be foolish, dangerously counterproductive, giving carte blanche to every other nuclear weapons state, environmentally destructive, and hugely expensive. Yet an ally of Trump, in his circle, is calling for open-air nuclear bomb testing. And that's why Robert Peters and anyone who listens to him, let alone takes him seriously, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
Here in the U.S. in Southern California, environmental advocates and local residents are accusing federal officials and Boeing Corporation of breaking promises to clean up the Santa Susana Field Laboratory site, only 35 miles from downtown Los Angeles. The U.S. Department of Energy has unveiled a plan that rethinks its approach to the contaminated soil cleanup at the Santa Susana Field Laboratory, a site marred by decades of rocket testing and a 1959 nuclear meltdown. The decision drew harsh criticism from environmental advocates and local residents who accused federal officials, along with Boeing, of dragging their feet and breaking promises to thoroughly clean up the site to background radiation levels to match the area's natural pre-contamination state. The groups said in a joint statement, this decision breaches a 2010 legally binding cleanup agreement and dramatically weakens site cleanup standards. Denise Duffield from Physicians for Social Responsibility said, if DOE succeeds, some of the most toxic areas of SSFL, the abbreviation for Santa Susana Field Lab, will continue to pose a serious risk of harm to people living nearby from migration of contaminants. The groups are urging Senator Alex Padilla to oppose DOE's plans. Melissa Bumstead of Parents Against SSFL, who lived near the site and whose daughter survived a rare form of leukemia not once but twice, said Padilla lives near SSFL and knows how important this is to public health. He is a member of the Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources, which is taking up the confirmation of Chris Wright to serve as the next energy secretary. Bumstead said, we hope that Senator Padilla can use his position to make sure that Wright withdraws this reversal in policy and pledged that DOE will live up to its previous cleanup commitments at Santa Susana. Regarding the Palisades Atomic Reactor in Michigan, the NRC has now revealed that Holtec, the company that now owns the facility, neglected safety-critical steam generator tube maintenance for 2 years, which severely accelerated degradation of the site for 22 months. This after Holtec applied for billions of dollars in public bailouts to restart the permanently closed nuclear power plant. Holtec's neglect of the safety-critical steam generators lasted from June 28th of 2022, the day Holtec took ownership of Palisades from Entergy, to May of 2024, about a two-year period. Holtec had vowed to restart Palisades rather than decommission it as previously promised. The restart, of course, being done at huge public expense. Arne Gunderson, chief engineer at Fairwinds Energy Education, who has more than 50 years of relevant expertise, including serving as an expert witness for Friends of the Earth on steam generator tube degradation at San Onofre, California, leading to the permanent shutdown of two reactors in June of 2013. Gunderson said, Holtec turned Palisades into a rust bucket for 2 years. It's a complete dereliction of duty and is proof that they have no nuclear operation experience. We will link to an article that spells out all the details on this on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 709. And this story relates strongly to the interview we have on this week's show with Harvey Wasserman. On a website called airqualitynews.com, the headline reads, California debunks a big myth about renewable energy. That myth being that it is not reliable. Sure, the sun sets every night and winds calm down, putting solar panels and turbines to sleep. But when these renewables are humming, they're providing the grid with electricity and charging banks of batteries, which supply power at night. A new study in the journal Renewable Energy that looked at California's deployment of renewable power highlights just how reliable the future of this energy might be. It found that last year, from late winter to early summer, renewables fulfilled 100% of the state's electricity demand for up to 10 hours on 98 of 116 days, a record for California. Not only were there no blackouts during that time, thanks in part to backup battery power, but at their peak, the renewables provided up to 162% of the grid's needs. Adding extra electricity, California could export to neighboring states or use to fill the batteries. Mark C. Jacobson, a civil and environmental engineer at Stanford University, said, "This study really finds that we can keep the grid stable with more and more renewables. Every major renewable, geothermal, hydro, wind, solar in particular, even offshore wind, is lower cost than fossil fuels." Or, we at Nuclear Hot Seat add, nuclear. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, don't you get tired of hearing pitches for support, for donations? I know I do. Yet, I contribute to others I believe in, at a level I can afford, and that's what I'm asking you to do as well. Nuclear Hot Seat continues to exist only through the donations that you, the listeners, provide. There are monthly, quarterly, and annual fees for the services required to get this show up and out. And when something special comes up where I need to travel to bring you the story, that's additional fundraising. And that's where I am now. In New York, at the United Nations, March 3 to 7, is the third meeting of states' parties on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Yes, we have a legally binding international treaty against nuclear weapons and a structure for the world to rid itself of nukes. Representatives of the 73 state parties that have already approved the treaty, the 94 that have signed and are in the approval process, and representatives of countries that are considering it and want to view the sessions will be held at that time. And I need to be there to cover it to bring all the news to you. I covered the second meeting of states parties for Nuclear Hot Seat in December of 2023 and produced two programs on it which captured the excitement, optimism, difficulties, hard work, and shared love of life of the international community. My intention is to do that again, and to that end, I need your help. A donation of any size will help cover my expenses getting to New York and staying for the better part of a week. Your donation is tax deductible, be it a one-time donation of any amount, or as a sustaining member for as little as $5 a month. You can do it by going to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and follow the prompts. Or you can send money directly through Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. I'm excited to once again be bringing you information from the front lines of anti-nuclear activism from around the world, and know that whatever you can do to help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. Harvey Wasserman is a veteran of 5 decades of activism against nuclear. He has authored books, organized demonstrations that deeply impacted the movement, helped successive generations of activists to learn the issues and the talking points, the actions they can take. In recent years, he has included a major outreach on alternative energy issues, especially solar, in the battle to eliminate nukes and reverse climate change. Now he has a new idea, to create our own coordinated media platform, the Eco Broadcast Network, or EBN, available to the public, so they can learn the talking points that use the truth we know and can substantiate as fact to contradict the enormously subsidized nuclear industry media propaganda platform. This network began organizing on January 27, 2025, and I spoke with Harvey Wasserman the next day, January 28, 2025. Harvey Wasserman, it's always great to have you here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Hey, it's good to be with you, Libby. You're the greatest.
Back at you. Harvey, you have been active on nuclear issues for decades now and have a unique perspective because of the level and extent of your involvement. In more recent years, you have been working on solar and other alternative energies as well, and how they can be used to get rid of nuclear completely. How did you evolve from a purely nuclear stance to one that is more involved with solar, wind, geothermal, and the rest of the genuinely renewable alternatives?
Well, just for the heck of it, Libby, let's go back to the very beginning. My ride with nuclear power actually began in 1959. In 1959, I had bar mitzvah, and the Schachters across the street gave me a copy of Our Friend the Atom from Walt Disney, which I did a report on in ninth grade. So from the time I was 13, I actually knew how a nuclear reactor worked, more or less. And if you'd asked me between 1959 and 1973, I certainly would have told you that nuclear power was a great thing. But in 1973, I was living on an organic farm in western Massachusetts, and the local utility came in and said they were going to build a nuclear plant 4 miles from our house. The local paper printed an aerial view of the site for the reactor and then superimposed an artist's conception of the two reactors. This was in Montague, Massachusetts, between Amherst and Greenfield, 90 miles west of Boston. And we took one look at this picture and we said, no, we're not going to let him do this. We never even had a meeting to say, well, nuclear this, blah, blah, blah. We just said, no way we're going to let this happen. And we stopped them. Montague reactors were never built.
How did you do that?
We formed a citizens movement, and we challenged the utility, which never knew what hit them. You know, we were just a bunch of activist hippies living on a farm. They never thought coming into the rural town of Montague, Massachusetts, that they'd run into resistance. And there was a guy from my farm, Sam Lovejoy, who on Washington's birthday, which back then was still February 22nd, using a crowbar, no explosives, knocked over the weather tower that they had put at the site of the proposed reactors. We made movies about that. And in fact, there's a film about our farm called Far Out, Life On and After the Commune, in which the last half hour, it's a 90-minute documentary, the last half hour shows the rise of the No Nukes movement. I was probably the first one to type no nukes. We put a page in the local paper about why we were opposed to the reactors, and we wound up being involved with the great Bonnie Raitt, Jackson Browne, Graham Nash, Carly Simon, James Taylor, and Bruce Springsteen. And in 1979, we did 5 nights in Madison Square Garden and an outdoor rally at Battery Park City, which now hosts a solar housing development in Lower Manhattan. We had over 200,000 people between the concerts and the rallies, actually kind of the Woodstock of the 70s. And you can still get the No Nukes album on CD and find it. So it's been a storied career. And in 1975, 4 years before Three Mile Island, we had in Amherst at UMass a gathering called the Toward Tomorrow Fair. And at that gathering was the great energy guru, Amory Lovins, who for the first time pretty much laid out the vision of a green-powered Earth. He was way ahead of the curve and understood that solar, wind, geothermal, battery storage could, in fact, provide 100% of the Earth's energy for industry and residents. So the vision was there. There was also a professor at UMass named William Hieronymus, who at this fair posited offshore windmills that would be 5 megawatts. Nobody believed that at the time. And now, all these years later, we have offshore wind turbines, which are 20 megawatts. So we've seen this progression, and the evolution of renewables has been nonstop in the correct direction. In other words, from the 70s on, wind power, solar panels, batteries, geothermal, they've all gone up in efficiency and down in price, as opposed to nuclear, which continues to rise every time you turn around in price. There have been 4 major reactor projects in the United States in the 2000s. Two of them at V.C. Summer in South Carolina completely failed. $9 billion holes in the ground, zero energy production in return for $9 billion. And then the 2 reactors at Vogtle in Georgia were originally going to cost $14 billion. They've come in closer to 40. And at this point in time, nuclear power, even the old reactors, been operating for 40 plus years, can't compete with solar. I mean, in a big way, 2, 3 times the price of solar, these operating reactors. That should end the argument right there. Solar and wind, they have been really one of the great technological miracles of human history. Because from the dates in the 70s, when the industry was just barely getting going, they have been unparalleled success. We had some, cylinder and a few failures along the way, which you would expect. We also have problems with wind, which does kill birds, although that is diminishing. And solar panels can cause electromagnetic radiation, which is harmful, but can be solved with manipulating the inverters and running the power through batteries before you put it in a house. The problems with renewables, which are real, are nonetheless not plutonium, for God's sakes. And they are solvable. For example, this is a great story. With wind power, the bird kill has been a very public issue. They have now cut the bird killing plague at wind turbines by 40% by doing, you know what, Libby? There are 3 blades on almost all big commercial windmills. Wind turbines have 3 blades. If you paint one of them black and leave the other two white, the bird kill drops 40%. So, we are looking for other solutions to that problem. But as I like to put it, no wind turbine ever killed a fish. Every nuclear power plant is on a body of water, except actually the 3 at Palo Verde, which in Arizona, which use wastewater, which is insane. But every nuclear reactor in the world kills massive numbers of marine creatures. The Diablo Canyon reactors at Avila Beach in California actually wiped out the abalone population before it even opened. They put chemical-coated pipes into the Avila Bay and completely wiped out the abalone population long before the reactors ever went online. Most reactors today, except for Palo Verde, they're all on rivers, lakes, and the ocean, and they all massively heat the planet, including the waters, and suck in massive quantities of water, which kill billions and billions of marine creatures. So when you hear somebody yelling and screaming about the bird kills at windmills, it is okay, that's we got to deal with that. But we are killing billions of fish, like your nuclear plants are, and we're not heating the planet. These people are running around saying nuclear power is a solution to global warming and is carbon free. First of all, it's not carbon free. Every atomic reactor emits radioactive carbon-14, and they also emit massive quantities of carbon dioxide in producing the fuel, mining, milling, enriching, transporting the fuel, and then storing it when it's waste. So atomic energy is a global warming disaster. In no way, shape, or form is it a solution for the climate crisis, nor is it carbon free.
How important do you feel it is that those who oppose nuclear also work to promote genuine renewables?
It's essential. And that's where, after finding reactors for a long, long time, I actually heard Buckminster Fuller speak once in Boulder, Colorado. And what he says was, the best way to defeat an obvious evil is to present a positive alternative. And so, you know, we were no nukes. We fought the reactors on the basis of radiation, potential explosions, cost, heat, you name it. We fought them tooth and nail, lack of evacuation, vulnerability to terror attacks. All those things are very, very real. We fought them that way for years and years. Then I realized, you know, we have to present an alternative. And the alternative we saw at the Toward Tomorrow Fair in 79 is renewables. And the good news is that renewables actually work. Solar panels are the cheapest, cleanest, safest, most reliable form with battery backup of electric generation. We have 2 million solar rooftops in the state of California. And our number one enemy, as it turns out, is not Donald Trump. It's Gavin Newsom, for God's sakes, who has been killing the solar industry for the last few years here in California and has kept the Diablo Canyon reactors operating, even though they are insanely dangerous and ridiculously expensive. So, you know, we're up against some serious irrationality because of the intransigent power of the fossil nuclear industry. But the bottom line is that we do have a solartopian alternative. We can sit down with anybody on this planet and run a scenario where renewables give us all our power, and it makes sense, and it works, and it's cheaper, safer, cleaner, more reliable, and more job-producing. But we run into the likes of Donald Trump and Gavin Newsom and the fossil nuclear industry, and that's the cross we're bearing here to try and win this.
How does the change in administration in Washington, D.C. look to play out regarding instituting genuine alternative energy as a national policy and our efforts to get rid of nukes?
We actually don't know yet about Trump and nukes. I mean, we're going to presume the worst. And the bottom line is that Biden's Inflation Reduction Act did an enormous amount to promote renewable energy. No doubt about it. It was a great godsend. And electric cars, which is another discussion. But Biden also had many, many, many billions of dollars laid out for nuclear. And, you know, that administration talked about nuclear as a solution to the climate chaos that we're facing, in which we're immersed already, being here in LA with these fires, these climate-based fires. But we don't know what Trump is going to do about nuclear. We do know he doesn't like wind. He doesn't like windmills and he doesn't like solar, but, you know, he got this crazy person, Elon Musk, next to him, and Elon's deep in the solar business and he's pushing these electric cars, Tesla, which are a mixed bag, believe me. Joe Enlai once said about the French Revolution and how it turned out, it's too soon to tell. What we do know is real, real damage has been done by Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, who likes to paint himself green. But the reality is, and this is important, Libby, the real guy in California was Jerry Brown. Jerry Brown really did promote renewables. He was not a fan of nuclear. And then with Arnold Schwarzenegger, I guess, got six, who was very pro-environmental. But they allowed Diablo Canyon to come along. They allowed San Onofre to come along. But we shut San Onofre through a local vote. We shut the reactor at Rancho Seco in Sacramento in 1989, a very big deal. Because it was owned by a municipal utility, we did have a referendum in Sacramento, which had real teeth. It wasn't just a straw vote. And the public voted in June of 1989 to shut the only reactor in Sacramento, and the only one I've ever been in because it's shut. But Rancho Seco is now surrounded by solar panels. Sacramento has moved very deep into a renewable future, largely because they had David Freeman, who ran the SMUD, the Sacramento Municipal Utility District, for a while, and really pushed it in a green direction. But, you know, you can look at aerial photographs now of the Rancho Seco nuke. It's shut, hasn't operated for almost 40 years, and then there's solar panels surrounding it that are doing great. Gavin Newsom, however, in 2018, There was a 2-year process from 2016 to 2018 that was spearheaded by Jerry Brown, who was the governor at the time. And they came up with a magnificent plan to phase out the 2 reactors at Diablo Canyon, which went online in the 80s, and phase in renewable energy, most specifically solar panels, most specifically rooftop. You know, you've got big controversies over these solar farms going into the desert and other places, but the bottom line is the best solar is on rooftops. The plan that Jerry Brown spearheaded was signed in 2018 by Gavin Newsom, who was then the lieutenant governor, and the state PUC, and the legislature, and the regulatory agencies, including the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and the unions, and the local governments, and the environmental groups. Everybody got together for this landmark plan to phase out the 2 reactors at Diablo Canyon by 24 and 25 and phase in renewables. At the end of those 4 years from 2018 to 2022, when Newsom intervened, we got 2 million solar rooftops in California. The industry was booming, really the most powerful solar industry in the world. 70,000 people working in the solar industry in California, as opposed to 1,500 at Diablo Canyon. And we were just rolling along. And then in April of 22, Newsom, who's now governor, intervened and forced the legislature, he really strong-armed the legislators, very ugly. A lot of the legislators were not happy. He used all his Stalinist power, Newsom did, to force the legislature in a midnight session, literally a midnight session, to rescind the phase-out deal at Diablo Canyon and give them $1 billion to PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric, to keep the reactors going at least up through 2030. And the reactors are so much more expensive than solar, wind, batteries, and conservation and efficiency that the additional utility costs to the people of California through 2030 will exceed $11 billion. It's staggering. It's an $11 billion handout to Pacific Gas and Electric. And this thing that he pushed through, a bill through the legislature, forces everybody in California to pay for Diablo Canyon, even though those of us in LA get no power whatsoever from Diablo Canyon. And the bigger problem at Diablo Canyon, and again, this is all on Gavin Newsom, he alone is responsible for pushing these reactors to continue to operate. We are terrified. Diablo Canyon is the 2 reactors there, and it's aptly named, are less than 50 miles from the San Andreas Fault. And the earthquake fault that destroyed Fukushima was 90 miles. San Andreas is half the distance from Diablo Canyon that the quake that destroyed Fukushima was. Of course, the tsunami at Fukushima had a hand in causing these 4 American-made reactors to blow up, but there's serious evidence that Unit 1 at Fukushima was already melting before the tsunami arrived. So we're terrified that this could happen at Diablo Canyon. There is no insurance. In 1957, the nuclear industry went to the Congress and got an exemption from the responsibility of having liability insurance. I mean, you can't drive a car in California without insurance, but you can operate 2 nuclear plants. Congress has intervened now and extended the exemption. The exemption was given in 57 with the Price-Anderson Act. They extended it every 15 years until the present, and now they've extended it 40 years. So if nuclear plants are still operating in the 2060s, that means that atomic energy will have gone 100 years without liability insurance. Diablo is particularly terrifying because the reactors are more than 40 years old. They're embrittled. There are all sorts of problems there. They could blow up. You know, maybe you and I were told for decades by the nuclear industry, well, a reactor can't blow up. It's physically impossible for an atomic reactor to blow up. Then Chernobyl blew up. And they said, well, that was a Russian reactor. Then the 4 reactors, which are all American-made at Fukushima, blew up on March 11, 2011, and they shut up. They don't say anymore that, you know, they don't talk about that now.
They change their talking points whenever the focus groups say people will react negatively to them. Clearly, nuclear and renewable are inextricably intertwined with each other and deserve to be because one is the answer to the other. You have now been calling out to national groups that deal with environmental and renewable energy issues to find ways that we can work together, particularly in communicating our messages. What has your outreach consisted of so far, and what has the response been like?
This no nukes movement has been incredibly successful. If you date it to the early 70s, or the first bumper stickers we printed at Montague Farm was in late 1973. So we've got a 50-year movement here. And in 1974, when we were just getting going, Richard Nixon said there would be 1,000 atomic reactors in the United States by the year 2000. In the year 2000, there were 104. Now we're down to 93 or 94, depending on how you cut it. And that's because we've had been out there marching. So the wide range of anti-nuke organizations is tremendous. It's nationwide. Of course, now with Zoom, it's much easier to bring people together. We still have a clamshell alliance in New Hampshire, which led the marches in the 1970s. They still meet. And there's a tremendous continuity. And we've been given the unexpected boost of a multi-trillion-dollar global renewable energy industry, which, as you say, is the flip side of the nuclear coin. It happened because, when we started fighting the Montague reactors, people said, "What's your alternative?" And we said, "Solar, wind." We had no idea what we were talking about. But it just worked out. Beginning at the Toward Tomorrow Fair in 75, somehow, the solar technology has created enormous jobs and enormous wealth and is viable.
You have a vision of something that you are calling the Eco Broadcast Network. What is that vision? What might it consist of? And what has the outreach consisted of so far to start building it?
Well, since we've been had these experiences now with right-wing takeovers at Twitter and Facebook and all the other stuff, and since we are very rarely heard on what's left of the mainstream media, even MSNBC and so on, we need our own network to push the reality that ecologically sound technologies work and that they are not only good for the economy, they're essential. We are not going to survive as a nation or as a species economically with these kinds of energy costs that come from nuclear and fossil fuels. Nuclear and fossil fuels are priced out. And if Trump succeeds in pushing away the transition to a solartopian economy in the United States, what's going to happen is we're going to be a third world country. China every year installs more solar capacity than we have in the entire United States. Every year, they match us with new solar. William Hieronymus got laughed at for saying there were going to be 5 megawatt offshore windmills. China is now building 20 megawatt offshore wind turbines and doing quite well with them. So all Trump is going to succeed in doing, and all Gavin Newsom has succeeded in doing in California, is pushing us back from the global market where we can't compete. Germany has shut its nuclear plants and they're having their struggles. But by 2030, Germany's energy costs will be by far the cheapest in Europe and matched only by the Chinese. And let's talk about cars. Trump is throwing up these massive tariffs against Chinese automobiles. And here we have Tesla. Teslas are what? 30, 40, 50 grand, right? For a Tesla. And by the way, they're not great cars in terms of structure. I mean, you bump the rear end of a Tesla, you got an enormous repair bill on your hands. The Chinese have a company called BYD. You can buy in China an electric car for 20 grand. I've been shopping here. I can't get one for less than 40. Trump is saying, "Oh, these tariffs are going to protect us, blah, blah." We are priced out of the global automobile market right now, and it's going to get worse. So, okay, we're going to have a domestic market for American electric cars, which he's attacking. Anybody with any brains knows that the future of the automobile is electric. There's minimal maintenance. They are faster, cleaner, cheaper to operate. You can go 300 miles on a tank of electricity for 10 bucks. Here in California, it costs you 50, 60. There's no future for gasoline cars, even if they weren't environmentally destructive. Just flat out technologically, economically, you can't match a gas-fired car up against an electric car. Trump and Newsom are simultaneously killing the American economy by attacking renewables. You look at Lazard, you look at Bloomberg, you look at all the people that follow the energy markets, it's all renewable. And Trump's going to stand in the way. Drill, baby, drill. Come on, man. These guys are dooming the United States industrial base to failure, to poverty. China, Germany, they are jumped light years ahead of us. And there's going to be hell to pay, not only ecologically, but economically. So the Eco Broadcast Network is based on the dual reality that a post-nuclear, post-fossil economy is the only way to go. And we need to get the word out. And we're not getting the word out through Twitter and Facebook or MSNBC even. So we need to go with our own websites, our own, like your podcast. Podcasting is going to be a major part of it, as Nuclear Hot Seat will be. And so we need our own voice, and that's where it's going to come.
If there are podcasts or writers or people with Substacks, whatever, who would be interested in becoming involved with the Eco Broadcast Network, how might they get in touch with you? What is the best thing for them to do?
My email is solartopia@gmail, solartopia@gmail.com. You can write me, and please do, and I'll hook you in with the website. For 5 years now, since April of 2020, we've been running a Monday Zoom call from 2 to 4 Pacific time called the Green Grassroots Emergency Election Protection Coalition Zoom call, or GREEP. We go from 2 to 4, like I say, the second hour we usually devote to the environment. And this last meeting where you were honored us with your presence, we have launched the Eco Broadcast Network. The point is to find as many electronic, internet-based, YouTube-based outlets as possible to spread our post-nuclear green-powered word. You will be as a vanguard podcaster right in the forefront of that. So we will be spreading this podcast and many, many more of yours and others and articles. I just put out a piece at progressive.org, the progressive magazine, which dates back 100 years. My new piece is about how Newsom and Trump are jointly killing or attempting to kill the renewable energy industry. And, you know, if Trump starts cutting, slashing the solar industry here, we're done. We're toast. We won't be able to compete. All of South America, all of Africa, all of Asia, all of Europe, everybody's going to go to solar, except the United States. Where's that going to leave us?
Unfortunately, with nuclear and with fossil fuels.
Well, even nuclear, this talk of small modular reactors, what they really are is silly mythological ripoffs. That's what they are, because they're not going to work. If you look at the costs, they've already failed. First of all, they can't get them up in any quantity in less than 10 years. Nobody believes they'll be, could ever be mass producing them in less than a decade, probably more like two decades. And the cost has already exploded far beyond their original costs and certainly far beyond existing solar. Nobody believes that solar is not going to continue to go down in cost. Nobody believes that wind is not going to continue to go down in cost. Geothermal also, which has been untapped and untalked about. And I will say, actually, at this point in time so far, Trump has not attacked geothermal. The basic pillars of a solar-topian economy, solar, wind, geothermal, battery backup, microgrids, they're all going down in price very rapidly, whereas fossil fuels are going way up and nuclear is just off the charts. As we mentioned, they've tried to build four new reactors in the 2000s, total catastrophes, a $9 billion wipeout FEC Summer, two reactors in South Carolina, a $40 billion wipeout at Vogtle in Georgia, and nothing else. There are no large atomic reactors under construction in the United States. The idea of reviving Three Mile Island and Palisades in Michigan, and they're talking about trying to start VC Summer back up. It's insane. Nobody with any sense at all is going to invest in this nonsense. You know, Trump might get government money in there. They're going to go nowhere. Three Mile Island is 50 years old, for God's sakes. It's like taking an old Corvair that you've got in your front yard up on blocks and trying to put tires back on and fire it back up. You know, it's ridiculous. Plus, we have more than 90 reactors in this country that are operating more than 40 years old. Every day they get more dangerous. I mean, literally more dangerous. They're all embrittled. Pipes are cracking. The concrete is cracking. I mean, if you really want to go to a horror show, listen to Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear describe the Davis-Besse reactor in Toledo. I mean, it's only a matter of time before they collapse just of their own obsolescence or from an earthquake. We've already had the Perry reactor in Ohio hit twice by an earthquake. North Anna in Virginia, the earthquake that damaged the Washington Monument also damaged the reactor in Virginia. And God forbid the big one hits in L.A., if the San Andreas goes off, Diablo will explode. Here we are. There's no future for these technologies. China is still building some atomic reactors, but clearly it's for weapons. The solar that they've done in China, along with the wind, has so vastly outstripped nuclear in terms of cost. And the small reactor is completely mythological. They don't make any sense whatsoever. They've already had one big NuScale, NUSCALE, the lead company that got the first licenses, already had their first major order canceled by the people that were going to buy these small reactors. Now they're talking, of course, we need these reactors to power data centers. But new technology coming out of China, especially in terms of crypto and AI, they can use way, way less electricity than they're claiming they need. SMRs are not going to happen. Well, there's one in China, one in Russia, but en masse, they're not going to get built. And the solar will get built and wind. The question is, will the United States be left behind? You know, we're still recovering from a lot of the stuff that Ronald Reagan did. We may never recover from a lot of the stuff that Donald Trump does, just in terms of technology and economic competitiveness.
Harvey, it is always an overflowing bounty of information when we talk. I'm very excited to be part of the Eco Broadcasting Network. And as we move forward together, I want to thank you for all your work, your decades of activism, and for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Libby, it's always a pleasure. And I got to say, in all my years of activism, I've rarely done anything I didn't want to do, and I will always want to do your show, so call me anytime.
You got it. That was the esteemed veteran anti-nuclear activist, Harvey Wasserman. If you have a podcast on issues dealing with the climate, or a Substack, a YouTube channel, or anything else, and want to learn how to participate in creating this media platform, you can contact Harvey directly at solartopia.me.com. I'll have the link up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 709. And know that Nuclear Hot Seat and this interview will be the inaugural program on the Eco Broadcast Network, or EBN.
Activists, shout out.
During the interview with Harvey Wasserman, he mentioned the actions of Sam Lovejoy, who chopped down the communications tower in western Massachusetts in the 1970s, a major step in stopping the building of two nuclear reactors in that area. Lovejoy's story was featured as the first nuclear resistor story on Nuclear Hot Seat number 702. Here with another in our monthly series of stories from our shared history of activism, this time on the UK's legendary Greenham Common Women's Peace Camp, is Jack Cohen-Joppa of the Nuclear Resistor newsletter.
In the Nuclear Resistor office, we have a squiggly piece of heavy wire coated with green plastic, a treasured trophy from a legendary anti-nuclear victory, a victory won by women. There's even a song about it from folk legend Peggy Seeger.
Hand in hand, the line extends all around the 9-mile fence. 30,000 women chant, bring the message home.
When I visited the Greenham Common Women's Peace Camp almost 30 years ago, the women gave me that small artifact from the chain link fence that once surrounded a British air base where U.S. nuclear missiles were deployed and then kicked out. From 1981 through the year 2000, women committed to nonviolent action to end the threat of nuclear war camped outside the gates of the Royal Air Force Base at Greenham Common, despite violent intimidation and repeated evictions, hundreds of arrests, and multiple jail terms. Back in 1980, the base had been picked to host the first deployment of U.S. nuclear-armed ground-launched cruise missiles. It was the height of the Cold War nuclear arms race, and these new missiles and their companion Pershing missiles being deployed at NATO bases across Europe were a colossal escalation of first-strike nuclear threats. Compared to ICBMs, these new intermediate-range missiles cut the flight time to incinerate Moscow in half. So in the summer of 1981, a few dozen women from Wales began a 100-mile peace march to Greenham Common. When they arrived in early September, four of the women chained themselves to the fence. Guards taunted them to stay as long as you want, so they did. The first missiles would not arrive until late 1983, but the women's audacious action and its mission proved a contagious idea. Soon, women across generations and backgrounds flocked by the hundreds to join the peace camp, now at all eight gates into the base. Guided by feminist principles, they organized themselves without hierarchy and without designated leaders who could be targeted by police and the hostile media. Allied peace camps sprang up at bases across Europe and in the U.S. The major demonstrations at Greenham created iconic images of feminist war resistance. In December 1982, the 30,000 women that Peggy Seeger sings about joined arms to embrace the base, fully encircling it while other women cut the fence and occupied the missile bunkers under construction. The next April, 50,000 people formed a 14-mile human chain connecting Greenham to the nuclear bomb factories at Aldermaston and Burfield. And in October, just days before the first missiles arrived, 400 women cut down over 2,000 yards of that 9-mile fence and nearly 200 were arrested. Despite media silence once the missiles had arrived, the women persisted. The nuclear war planners had imagined that mobile convoys of cruise missile launchers would blend into the countryside, their location hidden from the Soviets. But the fact that women were camped at the gates, primed for action and working with Cruise Watch, a network of civilian spotters, made sure that the location of each and every one of 68 convoys that roamed the Salisbury Plain from the spring of 84 to the summer of 1990 was known to the world. Women sometimes cut through the fence to damage and occupy convoy vehicles before they even left the base. Any tactical value of hidden missiles was totally obliterated by public protest inside the base, at the gates, on the roads, and in the villages the convoys raced through on their way to the training sites. Even Soviet Premier Gorbachev agreed that there could be no doubt that the committed women who held their ground at the peace camp and the millions of people they inspired into action worldwide played a significant role when he and President Reagan in 1987 signed the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. As a result, the cruise missiles were all withdrawn from Europe by 1991, their warheads removed, and the missiles themselves ceremoniously cut to pieces right here in Tucson, Arizona. The U.S. Air Force departed Greenham the next year, and the base was closed. The women remained until 2000, ensuring that the Commons was finally returned to the community. In 2002, a commemorative memorial garden was dedicated at the now historic campsite. But as we know, the nuclear planners did not go away, and long after those last U.S. nuclear weapons left Britain, they are now set to return. The U.S. F-35s at RAF Lakenheath could soon have their own American nukes. But opposition is building. The Lakenheath Alliance for Peace is hosting a peace camp there from April 14th to the 25th, 2025. For more information, visit lakenheathallianceforpeace.org.uk. This has been Jack Cohen-Joppa for Nuclear Hot Seat with another story from the Nuclear Resistor Archives to inspire your activism today.
Thanks, Jack. There was an excellent webinar on the dangers of radiation by Ian Fairley and Cindy Folkers, co-authors of the book, The Scientists Who Alerted Us to the Dangers of Radiation. They were interviewed for Nuclear Hot Seat number 704 on December 19, 2024. Now there's a video that includes visuals to go along with what they were saying, and you can access it on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 709. Here's a personal activist shout-out. Most of you don't know, but I spent more than 35 years professionally in theater, not only running a musical theater workshop, but writing plays which received more than 50 productions worldwide. Now I have a new play that I want to let you know about. It's called Atomic Bill and the Payment Due. It's an Oppenheimer-adjacent true story of media manipulation at the dawn of the atomic age and the New York Times reporter who sold his soul to get the story. It both asks and answers the question, how do you hide a nuclear bomb blast in plain sight? The play is very Trinity-centric, exploring the issues that came up around the explosion of the first atomic bomb in New Mexico on July 16, 1945. With this year being the 80th anniversary of the Trinity blast and the start of the atomic age, it could not be more timely for this play to get out. What I'm asking is if you are in or with a theater company or know of people who might be interested, I'm looking for readings to take place in as many locations as possible. The play will prove to be a learning experience for anyone involved in it, from the cast and crew out to any audience that comes in. As long as this is done as a reading, meaning everyone has a script in hand, and the only staging would be stand up, sit down, there will be no fee for use of the script. If you want to take it further, we can always talk. If this is something that interests you and you can help, contact me directly at info@nuclearhotseat.com. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, January 28, 2025. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered by email every week so you never miss a single episode, we make it so easy. The best way for us is to go to nuclearhotseat.com. There is a big honking yellow box that pops up. You cannot miss it. Put in your first name and an email address, and every week you will get one, just one email, with a link to the show and a short description of its content. Another option is if you regularly listen to podcasts, go to your favorite platform, look for Nuclear Hot Seat, and sign up there. Either way helps us get the word out about nuclear news from that all-important different perspective. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that to me in an email at info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help, especially with the meetings at the United Nations coming up at the beginning of March. We always appreciate your concern and your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, name of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, every nuclear reactor creates deadly radioactive waste that lasts forever. So for any program to fight climate change to be genuinely green, it must not include nuclear. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the Nuclear Hot Seat.
Nuclear Hot Seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear Hot Seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear Hot Seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear Hot Seat. It's da bomb.